Good morning to you all. Special shout out to the mamas in the audience. I hope that you feel special and valued and loved today. Those of us who are your husbands or your sons, we so appreciate the sacrifices that you make day in and day out. It may not look like it from a human perspective, but you are laying up treasure for yourselves in the heavens. And one day, the King's coming for you to give you that full inheritance that you are working on right now. And those of you who are spiritual mothers to those around you, we are so appreciative of the work that you do as well. You know, the Apostle Paul said at the end of Romans that Rufus's mother was like a mother to him as well. So whether you are a physical mother or you are a spiritual mother or you are both, thank you for the work that you do in the kingdom of God. If you would turn your Bibles to Daniel chapter 4, we're going to be there this morning as we continue our march through the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 4. You know, the book of Daniel takes place during a time when God's people are far away from the land that's been promised to them through Abraham all the way back in Genesis 12 and on through Abraham's sons. And so they are now finding themselves as the flotsam and jetsam of the nations. And they are finding themselves specifically as the doormat of the current King of Kings, as Daniel calls him earlier in the book, King Nebuchadnezzar of the Babylonians. And so they are powerless right now under the dominion of a wicked king, but they are reminded through the work of Daniel, who is working in the palace under the nose of Nebuchadnezzar and his friends, as well as the ministry of Ezekiel, who is not in the palace but is over by the canal with the rest of the exiles. God is sending prophets and messages during this time of their difficult and dark days to remind them that even though they're powerless, they serve a God who is far from powerless and able to humble the most arrogant and snooty of kings. So this chapter is a warning about pride and the consequences of pride, but this chapter is also a comfort and would have been comforting to the Jews to hear this because they are being ruled by someone that is far outside of their control, but God rules over the people of pride. And all we have to do as God's people is to keep putting our eyes on the one who is above all the names. The name above all names, as we just sang in that song. God is able to humble those who walk in pride. Let's think about this together. Let's begin reading the first 18 verses. Verse 1 of Daniel 4, King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace, and I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So I made a decree that all the wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. And the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and all the astrologers came in. And I told them the dream, which is a big difference from chapter 1. Tells them this dream. I told them the dream, verse 7, but they could not make known to me its interpretation. At last Daniel came in before me, he who was named Belteshazzar after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I told him the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you and that no mystery is too difficult for you, tell me the visions of my dream that I saw and their interpretation. The visions of my head as I lay in bed were these. I saw and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful, and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the visions of my head as I lay in bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. He proclaimed aloud and said thus, chop down the tree and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze amid the tender grass of the field. Let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. What a remarkable passage of scripture this is that kind of resembles what we saw as Daniel opens, but this chapter is different in a couple of ways. First of all, what I want to notice about chapter 4 is, did you notice how we've been seeing this theme that Nebuchadnezzar kind of rises up and he does something really stupid? He's trying to attract glory to himself. He's trying to throw his weight around. He is shown, oh, there's a God who's above my gods, and this God is actually even above me too. What a revelation that is. And so in chapter 2 and chapter 3, those chapters end with this eruption of praise happening from a source that nobody would have expected. But what's interesting about chapter 4 is it's going to end with praise, but it's also going to start with praising God. Nebuchadnezzar, up until this time of the book, he has just been told to us from the perspective of other people. You know, Daniel is writing about him. Other people are witnessing his actions and his speech. But now in chapter 4, this pagan king is taking up the pen himself, and he is writing out this embarrassing account of his life and when he was brought down from the top to the bottom. And he's telling everybody about this. Do you usually do that with your worst days or your worst years or months? Do you say, okay, I'm gonna craft an email that I'm going to send out to, you know, everybody that I possibly know about how I was brought down. But this is exactly what he does. But his eyes now, as he writes chapter 4, are no longer on him. They're on the God Most High, who he recognizes as far above him. And so I think the way that this chapter opens creates a sense of anticipation, some interest in us as the reader. So why is he starting out like this? What could have possessed Nebuchadnezzar to begin all of this story with this praise that he gives in verse 2 and verse 3 after he greets all the nations that he rules over? Well, we don't have to wait too long to find out, because we have the vision described to us in pretty interesting detail. I want you to imagine this image in your mind that we read about in the text. Imagine that you see this tree that is way taller than any Californian redwood that you could go see in a national park. It just towers above everything else. And it is so tall and it is so big that you can actually see it from the ends of the earth. So this is kind of a flat earth picture that we have here in the text. And so you can see it from everywhere that you look. And it's so big that it is a fantastic provider for everything and everyone around it. So it's got shade that can cover any amount of beasts and birds. It has lots of food. Did you notice in verse 12? Two different times in verse 12, it emphasizes how it's got food for all. You know, in it was food for all. And then at the end of the verse, all flesh was fed from it. And how tall is this tree? Well, it says its top reached to the heavens. Does that remind us of what happens in Genesis chapter 11? You remember, everybody kind of moves in a big clump to the land of Shinar, the place where Babylon now sits here in the book of Daniel. And they construct a city and they start to construct a tower in order to make a name for themselves. So this was not a good desire. It was not a great construction project because it was full of pride. But they want to reach up to the heavens. They say that that's their goal. Well, this tree actually achieves that goal. It is way up there. It touches the skies. But Babel, of course, is the origin story for Babylon. And I think it's even the same word in the Hebrew or very close to it. And so what happens to Babel is now going to happen to this tree as well. And in the king's dream, you know, he says about this dream, like he said about the first dream, it was really scary to me. Because something scary happened to the statue. Remember, the rock came out of nowhere, no human hands carved it out, and it just came and whomped on the statue and just demolished it and killed that thing. Well, what happens to the tree? An angel comes down and says, chop it up, lop it up, strip it and scatter it, but leave the stump, because we're not done with this tree yet. We're just going to destroy most of it. It's not the complete end of the tree, though. So God used Nebuchadnezzar as an axe to take down the tree of Judah, but now God is going to go after the person that he used to bring judgment. Now that judgment is going to come on this man. And what's interesting to me about this, and I didn't know this until I was reading some books for this sermon, the image of a tree to symbolize a mighty king or a god, that was pretty common to do that in the ancient world. And it was also common to do that in other places in the Bible. In the prophet Ezekiel, who again worked and lived in Babylon around the same time as the prophet Daniel, in Daniel 19, or in Ezekiel 19, we see this image of a mighty tree being a cedar being used to symbolize the dynasty of the house of David. In Ezekiel 31, a proud Pharaoh who was full of arrogance and needed to be humbled, he was reminded by God about Assyria, who was like a cedar tree that got chopped down. And this was a really common symbol in the pagan world too. The Egyptian goddess Hathor was symbolized sometimes as a big, mighty tree. Assyrian kings were sometimes associated with a big tree of life, and they gave protection and nourishment to the people that are underneath them. It's just a really common image. So it's kind of interesting that the Chaldean sorcerers come in, they hear the dream, and they say, oh, we have no idea what this is talking about. It could be that they genuinely had no idea. But because it's so common, and because the dream itself says this is talking about a person, not just, you know, this tree out here in the middle of the forest. I mean, verse 15, verse 16, there's a lot of hymns in there, a lot of hisses. It's pretty hard to escape that interpretation that this tree is a guy. oh, we have no idea, O king, who this guy is. It could be that this is a lack of knowledge, but it might also come from a lack of courage. Because who wants to tell Nebuchadnezzar that he's going to get cut down? Do you want to be that messenger? Probably not. But regardless of the reason, they have no answers. They give no answers. And it's Yahweh's man who comes in to save the day. Let's read about what Daniel says. Verse 19, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and his thoughts alarmed him. And the king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream be for those who hate you, and its interpretation for your enemies. The tree that you saw, which grew and became strong, so that its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth, whose leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which beasts of the field found shade, and in whose branches the birds of the heavens lived. It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reaches to heaven, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the fields. Let it be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beasts of the field till 7 periods of time shall pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king. It is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And as it was commanded to leave the stump of the roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be confirmed for you from the time that you know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity. So Daniel is called in, and he is given the dream, and then he is given by God the interpretation. He is able to explain this all in complete detail. And it's a very scary picture now that the king is presented with. It's interesting that in Daniel 2, this man is called the King of Kings. And here, like in chapter 2, God is reminding him that he's got power and glory. He's got dominion. He's got authority over everyone that he rules over. And it's quite an impressive empire. But remember in chapter 3, he tries to force all of his officials to bow down to an image that he has made, and has made that equivalent to allegiance to him. And now God is requiring that Nebuchadnezzar bow to him, the true God, the King of Kings. And it's going to be a painful experience to him, because Nebuchadnezzar is not going to do it willingly. This is going to be forced until the time comes when he is able to do it willingly. And since pride is one of those things that causes us to just lose our minds, it's really interesting that Nebuchadnezzar will lose his mind in an animal-like kind of way. And he's going to, instead of living in a palace with rich robes and concubines and wives and big fancy feasts every day, now he's going to be put out to pasture, quite literally. He's going to be eating grass like an animal, and he's going to even look like an animal, as we're going to find out in what happens to his physical body. And all who trusted in his power, everybody who fit under his shade, who ate his fruit, they're going to find themselves scrambling for another tree now because he's going to get cut down. I think this passage is such a perfect illustration of Psalm 146, where the writer says there, put not your trust in princes. Put not your trust in princes, in a son of man in whom there is no salvation. When his breath departs, he returns to the earth. On that very day, his plans perish. Blessed is he whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord. Psalm 146, 3 through 5. If your comfort and your security rests in finding the strongest person that you can attach yourself to, be that a politician, be that a member of the Lord's church, be that a family member, eventually you are going to reach a day where that tree falls in some sort of way, in some sort of moral way, or death comes and you're going to be disappointed. But the Lord, by contrast, as you keep reading on in Psalm 146, the Lord keeps faith forever. He executes justice for the oppressed. He gives food to the hungry. He sets the prisoners free. He opens the eyes of the blind, lifts up those who are bowed down. By the way, all those things can be described for Jesus Christ. That's what he does. Make your home under his tree and you won't be disappointed. I want to talk about this, though, as well, as we're thinking about this passage. This is just such a remarkable place in Scripture to me. I want you to think about Daniel's personal reaction to this dream and its interpretation as he's giving it to this man. Let's evaluate Daniel's position for a moment. Daniel is talking to the man who has destroyed his nation, who has slaughtered so many of his people, who has burned Solomon's temple to the ground. This is the man who has captured him personally, who has castrated him personally. Remember in chapter 1, he's given over to the care of the chief of the eunuchs. What does that say about what Daniel was? Yeah, he's a eunuch too. This is the man who indoctrinated him with all the hooey of Babylon. This is the man who tried to incinerate his three best friends in a superheated furnace. If there had been an ounce of hatred for this king, do you think that that would come out somehow in the way that Daniel talks to him in this moment? This is the perfect opportunity to crow over his enemy. Oh, you want to know what the interpretation of this dream is? I'm going to tell you. It means humiliation is on the horizon for you, Nebuchadnezzar. It means you're going down. And it means that the moment that happens, it's party time at Daniel's house. I'm going to invite every Jew that I know, and we're going to dance on the reputation that is now in ruins. And we're going to love every single moment of it. Meanwhile, you're going to be eating grass like a cow and lost your mind. There's so many things Daniel could have said if he had a heart that was black, but he didn't. You don't see any of that. Long before Jesus said, I want you to love your enemies, and I want you to pray for those who persecute you, Daniel in verse 19 said, after he was alarmed about this, and after Nebuchadnezzar said, oh, Daniel, I mean, whatever this means, this is not worth you getting into a tizzle about, Daniel looks at him and says, paraphrasing, I really, really wish that I didn't have to tell you this. I really wish this is not talking about you, but is talking about some other king that's your enemy. That is amazing. when you put this in the context of everything that this king has done to Daniel and Daniel's friends and Daniel's people and Daniel's nation. It is incredible. And then, you know, you get down to verse 27 and you don't see any indications of pride welling up in Daniel's heart. You instead see an obedience to the letter that Jeremiah wrote to the exiles in Babylon in Jeremiah 29, where Jeremiah said, I want you to do good for the nation that you now find yourselves a part of. Daniel applies that here, and he looks at Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, you know what? I want to give you some advice. And this is coming from Daniel's heart. He's being sincere about this, I have no doubt. He says, please, please, let me help you here. Okay, stop sinning. That's pretty general. But I think, you know, you can imagine the kinds of sins that a pagan king might get himself involved in. He said, stop doing that. Instead, practice righteousness. Practice the ways of the Hebrew God. And that would be an act of humility on Nebuchadnezzar's part. That's the advice, though. And he says there in that verse, take care of the people in your empire who's been stepped on. Maybe as a result of policies that you put in place and things that you've done, O king, there are oppressed people around you. Yeah, it looks really great when you stroll around your palace, but go to the slums of Babylon. Go to the far corners of your empire and take care of the people on the fringes. They're the ones that need help. Just as pride overinflates the picture that we have in our own minds about ourselves, pride also dehumanizes the other people around us so that when we hurt those people or we slight them, and we don't do good for them, it becomes a trivial issue. It was a trivial issue for Nebuchadnezzar right now. And Daniel tries to help him with that. He had a lot to change, but he obviously didn't listen to that advice because as 12 months go by, as we keep reading in chapter 4, he is the same self-absorbed autocrat that he ever was before. He's no different as the text picks up after this. I think by way of application, as we think about ourselves and our own lives, whether or not we listen to advice, whether we are open to correction, that is a big, big indicator about whether we are full of pride or not. I haven't been here very long, but I'm pretty confident that there are people in this room who would love me enough to tell me when I'm really off base, if I needed to hear that. If you're married, does your spouse know that they are allowed to give advice to you? That they are allowed to be frank with you, if needed, about areas of your life where growth is needed? If you are a member of this congregation, do the local shepherds here know that they are allowed to be frank with you about areas of your life where things need to be aligned better according to God's will? Sometimes elders are criticized because the sheep kind of look at the shepherds and say, well, you know what? They're general decision makers over our congregation, but I really wish they would be more in tune with personal lives and get into the weeds with the sheep. And sometimes that criticism is valid, but the other side of that coin is, how do the sheep feel about if the shepherds actually did that? If shepherds came alongside of us in really personal ways and said, okay, let's talk about marriage. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about that. How are you doing with this? Do sheep want that? We as the sheep need to ask ourselves hard questions about whether we are willing to be led or whether we are going to take our ball and go to Gibson City if that happens. There's a lot of questions about this that are hard to answer because they expose the inner workings of our hearts. And obviously, the maturity of whatever advice that we hear is going to need to be filtered through the words of God. Obviously, the maturity of the advice we hear is going to depend on who is giving it. But regardless of the source, spiritual advice coming from another Christian, another follower of God, needs to not be dismissed outright, and especially if it's coming from those who are charged to have the concern of our souls at the forefront of their minds. God does not bring judgment on people or nations without warning them about that first. And so if I have a defensive, you can just stay out of my life, thank you very much, perspective, then I'm going to suffer for my own foolishness. Just like this king suffered when he took the advice of his chief magician and just kind of threw it in the wastebasket. The default posture of my heart has to be, I am sure that there are other people in this congregation who can see things about me that I can't see very well. And so if I've got broccoli in my teeth, physically or spiritually, you are my friend for telling me about that. I mean, that's an awkward kind of moment. Hey, you got broccoli in your teeth. Oh, I do? But I would much rather you tell me that at the beginning of the day than having never told me that and I go home at the end of the day and then look in the mirror and go, oh my word, I spent the entire day having that right there. Do you want to spend your entire life with broccoli in your teeth? I don't either. We are put around each other and around the words of God to help each other with all this kind of stuff. And so if we walk around with the right kind of attitude, we're going to be in a proper position to receive constructive criticism when it comes our way and then change where it's needed. So I love Daniel's reaction. I don't love Nebuchadnezzar's response because we have to read about what happens because he didn't take the advice. Verse 28, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, and the king answered and said, is not this great Babylon, which I built by my mighty power as a royal residence for the glory of my majesty? While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven. O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox. And 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. Immediately, the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven away from among men and ate grass like an ox. And his body was wet with the dew of heaven until his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers, and his nails were like bird's claws. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the hosts of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the God of heaven, the King of heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. I want you to notice how this scene plays out here. Nebuchadnezzar has not gone to the gate of his city and issued this public proclamation about what he says in there in verse 29 or so, when he goes up to the city, or when he's walking on his palace roof, and he is declaring these arrogant things. God has been extremely patient with this man. A full year has gone by. Nebuchadnezzar is just the same. And now it has come to a point where just the expression of Nebuchadnezzar's heart, as far as I know, he's not talking to anybody else on this roof. Maybe there are other people there, but he's just looking out and kind of speaking to himself about what he is seeing. But that is enough to condemn him, because God cares about sin at the level of the heart. See the Sermon on the Mount for more info on that. We've got to think about our hearts here. What's the condition of what's going on inside of our minds? Remember Psalm 15:2, that the one who can dwell on God's holy hill is the one who speaks truth in his heart. All of us have this running dialogue going on inside of us, no matter who we are. We're always talking to ourselves. We're always processing the world around us, the other people around us, the experiences that we have. And we need to be so, so careful about what we are saying, what we are speaking to ourselves. Do we just have our eyes on our own needs and preferences and whether the world around us conforms to what we think should be and should happen? Do we think about how other people should be thinking and should be acting according to what we think is best, because we're always the best judges on how people should live, you know? Or do we have our thoughts mostly centered in the dialogue that we run in our heads on who God is, his attributes, his history with his people, and who he's helping? Do we have our eyes, when we look at other people, is it with the dialogue of, how does this person need help? How does this person need encouragement and uplifting? And how can I meet that need for them? Daniel, remember in verse 27, he tried to turn the king's thoughts to that cause. You know, you have the power to rise up and help these people, Nebuchadnezzar. Are you doing that? You need to. He didn't at that point, but he has a different attitude after he's humbled. And so after his humbling, I think it is so neat to see the dousing of blessings that God chooses to pour onto the lap of this man who had steadfastly refused to humble himself before this moment. So as the text picks up right after, we're told about what he turned into. Remember how he says his reason returned to him after verse 34, he lifted his eyes to heaven. That's not the action of an animal. This is describing a very intentional submission to the God who has put him in this condition that he now finds himself in. And so that's just so interesting that after he went crazy, his empire was returned to him. You know, usually in a pagan empire, for people who are not serving the true God, if you go crazy and you lose it, you are probably quietly taken out of the way so that somebody who is in their right mind can seize the throne and the reins of power. But in this case, Babylon, the mightiest empire of all this time, is just sitting there waiting for him to come back to it, because God has his finger on this. And not only that, did you notice how the text says, I didn't just get back what I had. Still more greatness was added to me. Does this not remind you of Job? You remember how Job loses at the beginning of the book his 10 kids and all of his stuff. But then as the book concludes, after Job's humbling for different reasons, Job gets twice as many animals as he had before. He gets 10 children again after his time of suffering, because this is the God that we serve. In Nebuchadnezzar's case, he's not vengeful. He's not bitter. He sends his rain on the just and on the unjust, according to Jesus in Matthew 5. He loves those who don't love him very well or don't love him at all. He's ready to pour out his good things as soon as possible on this stubborn man who's resisted his lordship. If he's happy to share his blessings in this kind of way, is that the attitude and posture of our hearts as well? It's challenging stuff. I want to, as we wrap things up, remind us of what happens in Jesus' parable in Matthew 32, 31, and 32. I'm going to read it again. He put another parable before them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed that a man took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all seeds. But when it has grown, it is larger than all the garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches." Reading through Daniel 4, I was so strongly reminded of what Jesus says about himself and how the kingdom, the family, the authority and dominion that he has, that he's setting up in these gospel accounts, is like a tree. But it's not a tree that's going to get hacked down and lopped off and the fruit scattered from it. That happened to Jesus Christ so that the strength and security of this tree can last into eternity. Are you resting under the shade this tree? Am I? Are we taking the fruit of this plant into our lives? Are we rejoicing in this King that has a name above all names? God help us to appreciate the shade and the fruit of what is talked about here more than we do any other tree. Appreciate your attention to the words of God. We're going to stand up and sing the song that's been selected by Keith at this time.